Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Stephen Sewer. I'm program chair of the Now and Then Speaker Series, and I'll be your moderator for tonight's program. In this year-long series, which was conceived by Dr. Carol Fleming, the Commonwealth Club of California will examine the evolution of American life and culture since World War II from a variety of perspectives. We're inviting recognized leaders to share their knowledge and observations about this important period of history from their particular area of expertise. In addition, we would like speakers to extrapolate about the trajectory of their field. What can we expect in the next 10 years? With the baby boom generation fast approaching retirement, this seems an appropriate time to pause and consider what these changes have meant to the people who have lived through this period of history and to American culture more broadly. Tonight, the Commonwealth Club of California is delighted to present our next Now and Then speaker, Charles Fracchia, founder of the San Francisco Museum and Historical Society, who will provide the historical framework for the entire Now and Then speaker series. Charles Fracchia is a native San Franciscan. He was educated at the University of San Francisco. Go Dons. He conducted his graduate work at USF Law School, San Francisco State University, and the University of California at Berkeley. Over the past half century, Charles has worked in all aspects of the investment business, as well as serving as an academic. He has taught humanities at San Francisco State University and currently teaches at the Fromm Institute at the University of San Francisco. He is also department chair for the library system of City College of San Francisco. Charles has written 12 books and numerous articles, including 3 books on the city of San Francisco. Charles' newest book, When the Water Came Up to Montgomery Street, San Francisco During the Gold Rush, will be published this fall and is the first narrative history of the Gold Rush's impact on San Francisco's history. Charles founded the San Francisco Museum and Historical Society and continues to serve on its board as president emeritus. Today, Charles is widely recognized as the leading San Francisco historian. Please welcome Charles Fracchia.
Good evening. And I'd like to start off tonight by just 3 comments. First, to thank the Commonwealth Club of California for having me speak here on my favorite subject, and that is San Francisco. As I was putting together these comments, and I've told Stephen that I've never worked so hard in a talk in my life, because when you're trying to prognosticate about the future, it always makes you a little nervous. But I thought to myself, my gosh, I've lived here for a number of years. I'm now beginning to feel like the old-timer on Death Valley days. And then I realized how many people in the audience tonight will remember Death Valley days. I want to also mention that my comments and opinions tonight are my own, do not represent any organization I'm involved with. They don't even represent my family's ideas. Okay, past, present, and future. I was born towards the end of the Great Depression, of a working-class family in a working-class area of a city that is no more. It was a world of certain fixed ideas and a world which I'm going to spend the next few minutes talking about. My memories of the Great Depression are confined, which was a very small boy, are confined to the memory of those who were what were then called down and out, who would come to the door of my home, and my mother and my grandmother, who lived with us, would fix them sandwiches, which they would eat on the stoop in front of the house. 4 years after I was born, the United States went to war on December the 7th, 1941. And there, as I was growing up in the face of this war, my memories were a little bit elongated. I remember the disappearance of the Japanese from San Francisco in the entire state of California. I remembered the tremendous fear that was a part of the atmosphere, and I remember how changed San Francisco and the Bay Area had become. Changed from many perspectives. One is that the somewhat sluggishness of the 30s Depression had turned into the frenzy of the war period. And I, as I look around, I don't see many people here probably remember that period. But it was a period in which San Francisco was transformed. Single-family houses around the city were transformed into apartment houses. There were military people throughout the area. Friends of my family or family members would come to California or San Francisco before being shipped off, and we'd meet them in the lobby of the Fairmont, or the lobby of the Mark Hopkins or whatever, and everywhere you saw there were military personnel. Around the area itself, there were industries which hummed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, making Liberty ships and so forth. And we saw tremendous migrations, demographic migrations, that began to change the face of the city. It was a city of particularities. If you asked, where do you live in San Francisco? Somebody would probably say St. Paul's Parish. If you talked about where did you go to school, you didn't mean Harvard, Yale, or the University of San Francisco. You meant where did you go to high school. The big game was St. Ignatius and Sacred Heart, or Balboa and Galileo, not Cal and Stanford. Neighborhoods were of the utmost importance. I feel today, living in San Francisco, that I could live here another 50 years, I still wouldn't know my neighbors. That was not the case then. You knew your neighbors interacted with you. This was, of course, not just true in San Francisco. It was true in many of the cities of the United States. I'm going to go on in this way a little bit later on to give us a sense of the chiaroscuro between the world then and the world today. Well, let us turn from me to my father. My father came to the United States, San Francisco, in 1914 at the age of 11, obviously making him born in 1903. Died in 2000, so 96 years, his life spanned the century. And I used to love growing up or getting older and to the day he died, thinking about this man's life, born 3 years before the Orville and Wilbur Wright flight of the airplanes, and certainly before computers, certainly before so many things. And he was a great raconteur, would love to talk about his time in Europe, his life in Europe, about his time here in the United States. And he helped me, as I later became more and more interested in San Francisco history, to realize that the world I grew up in, the San Francisco I grew up in, had a continuity with San Francisco of the late 19th century. It was not until the 1960s that the break began to be made with that continuity. He would talk about Prohibition, for example. And just the other day, I was asked by NPR to appear on Forum to talk about the commemoration of the last day of Prohibition, thank God. And 75 years ago, a few weeks ago. And my father had just had multiple stories about that time. San Francisco, while the state of California indeed did vote for the amendment for Prohibition, San Francisco was alone among all the major cities in the United States that voted against it. And it was never much enforced here, believe me. My father used to always talk about the fact there must have been a huge increase in religious life because sacramental wine production skyrocketed. You had in 1917 the Red Light Abatement Act. That didn't seem to go very far either. That was the idea of stopping prostitution. I see from today's paper we're still at it. He lived through World War I, in which he had gotten a job at the Bethlehem Steel Shipyard, where he was worked on building the ships that we sent abroad. And then during World War II, in which I was around as well, was still working for Bethlehem Steel. Let's talk about the composition of San Francisco in the city that I grew up in. This composition, this world, this situation that I'm going to describe, lasted until the mid to late 1960s. And so as I was growing up, not only I, but all my compeers, all the people who lived in the neighborhood, all the people who lived in the city, really expected that this city would stay very much as it had been for almost 100 years. It was politically conservative. It astonishes people today when I tell them that from the election of November 1911 until the mid to late 60s, every mayor of San Francisco was a Republican. The Board of Supervisors were Republican. Today, if you had a Republican convention in San Francisco, you could hold them in a closet. There was financial restraint. I remember always one of the great struggles in the Board of Supervisors and in the city was to make sure we don't overspend what revenues we have coming in. And you can imagine, I mean, that was a bit of a harum-scarum operation for a long time. And as I'll talk about later, in the aftermath of World War II, of course, the rising rates of real estate and so forth online caused revenues to increase. But still, there was a sense of we need to stay within our means. There was much smaller government and a much tighter sense of community in that government. Going to City Hall, for example, in the 1940s or 50s, you saw a very small coterie of employees, very smaller proportion of governmental revenues than we see today. There was also general civility in politics, something that has gone out of our life today. You could have people who detested each other personally, have people who were very different politically. Nevertheless, a certain genial civility was kept up, something, again, that we do not see today. One of the things that fascinates me about life in San Francisco today is its transparency. You got to do everything in the open. This was not a virtue in the time that I grew up in this city. And I'll give you an example of that in the sense that, and I'll come to that later, the oligarchy that ran the city in up until probably the 1970s. In the 1950s, Mayor George Christopher, the last Republican mayor of San Francisco, was very earnest about having the New York Giants, come to San Francisco. And you recall that's the time the two of the three New York teams moved out west, the Brooklyn Dodgers moving to Los Angeles, the New York Giants moving to San Francisco. And he made a variety of promises, a new stadium, lots of parking, And so the process began with a kind of a sweetheart deal where one of his great backers, a man by the name of Charlie Harney, who had some land down in the southeastern part of the city around Candlestick Point, sold it to the city for an inflated price. San Francisco then, as has proved true down the years, did not like the idea of handing over taxpayers' money to multimillionaires. And so there was a tremendous movement, as there was for the 49ers, et cetera, and for the Giants, where the city basically said, this is not for us. Well, getting a sense of that opposition, Christopher decided he would call on the oligarchy that ran the city to come together. And so he brought up 10 cases of the best scotch, the Pacific Union Club up at the top of Nob Hill, called in all the disparate groups of this coalition, and by the time the scotch had been drunk, there was a deal, and the bond issue passed handily. Now, this is very much a mark of a mark of how the coalition did business. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. You wash my hand, I'll wash yours. It was done very much on the level of a multi-layered group. What was this combination? What was this group? Here are the components. You had a goodly number of German-Jewish businessmen. You had generally Anglo-Saxon corporate heads and professionals. the head of PG&E, the head of Standard Oil California, later became known as Chevron, and so forth, on the many of the great banks. Then you had what I'll call an Irish-Italian rank, small businessmen, professionals, unions, and so forth. And this then reached into what I call the municipal apparatus, fire, police department, and so forth on the line, civil service. And this was fused into this was the coalition that ran the city. And it's interesting because the fact you could have a millionaire businessman and you'd have a union leader coming together in this amalgam. The world in which these people lived in was that not all that far away. Now, this group would stay in power until probably the 1960s, when Jack Shelley became the first mayor, first Democrat to be elected mayor since for a long, long time, and began to have to respond to the changes which were affecting society throughout the United States and actually throughout the world in the 1960s, and I'll talk more about that a little bit later on. Shelley, who had been a liberal Democrat, was very nonplussed by the rising radicalism of the world he was now presiding over in San Francisco. He was followed by Joseph L. Alioto, a man who was unlucky in his timing to be mayor and unlucky in his problems with regard to the lawsuits against Look magazine, some of you may recall, when he was accused of being involved with the mafia and so forth, and also a man who saw the world he knew come tumbling apart. I want to spend a little bit more time talking about the particularism of that era that I grew up in, the late 30s, the 40s, 50s, and a bunch of some of the 60s. Unlike today, when we see this tremendous moving around of people, people didn't move around then. There were people I knew who had lived 2-3 generations in the family house. People who, once they settled in a neighborhood, stayed there for the rest of their lives, and who plugged into the organizations that, depending on what their background was, catered their lives. Churches were a big factor. Protestant and Catholic synagogues were a big factor. These provided not only worship and religious aspects, but also a social sense. It also provided a whole outreach to the community as far as helping out those less fortunate. Schools were very important. I must say it breaks my heart today to see the status to which public schools have come to in this city. And I think to myself, the grammar school that I went to, there are 50 students in the class. There was one teacher who was also the principal and who had no secretary. And I must say, somehow or other, I got educated. And that certainly happened throughout. Whereas today, the stories one hears from school teachers are absolutely horrible. And so this was, while a less affluent era, certainly from the point of view of education, people taking this whole aspect seriously. Neighborhoods is something that fascinates me. As Stephen mentioned, I founded the San Francisco Museum and Historical Society in 1987. Was president for many, many years. Now they give me the title of founder and president emeritus. I feel I should be dead. And our theme this year is the neighborhoods of San Francisco. We did Chinatown last month. We're going to do the Richmond this month. And we're going to do South Market in March and so forth throughout the year. And neighborhoods have always fascinated, because it is in neighborhoods that my sense of San Francisco was engendered. This was a time in which you bought a home, and as I said, probably lived there for the rest of your life. you knew your neighbors. If you were ill, they helped out. I can still remember my mother would get ill. The neighbors would all come over to hang the washing out on the line, as they used to say, which traversed your backyard. Brought over meals. There was a sense of coming together, which, as we all know, is very much bereft in our society today. Organizations were of the utmost importance. These were either church or synagogue organizations. They were fraternal organizations. I can still remember going Market Street, watching the Red Men march and the Druids. I know you're all looking at me like I'm crazy. And the list goes on and on and on. My father going out at night to a YMI meeting or this meeting or that meeting, in which the members got together and formed a bonding and an important coming together. A coming together that frequently translated itself into taking care of the neighborhood. You're not going to have much crime if someone's grandmother's hanging out the window looking at the street for several hours at a time. And so, again, I don't want to sound like an old curmudgeon, you know, oh, when I walked in the snow to school. But what I witnessed was a world in which you had that happen. One of my daughters is here tonight, spent a stint in Queens. And when I visited her there one time, I said, this could be the neighborhood I grew up in. There were grandmothers hanging out of windows. There was play in the streets. It was a sense of life in which was very important for the people thereof. Use of time has always fascinated me. What do people do with their time? What do people do with their days? It's a hallmark of something. I can't quite figure out what that something is. But it's a hallmark that is very, very important, I think. What do people do with their days then? They worked hard. Many of the people in my neighborhood attended large gardens, listened to the radio. There was no television at this time. Listened to the up until the early, mid-1950s, listened to the radio, television, and went to lots of meetings or just visited each other. I mean, can you imagine today ringing the doorbell, some friend lives down the street and say, hi, how are you? Oh, come in, have a cup of coffee. And then, you know, they're sitting down there knitting while they're talking. I mean, I did that one time. I thought I was going to be shot. I mean, it just there is a San Francisco that I grew up in. Let's talk about the San Francisco of today. Let me add just a couple things. It was a San Francisco in which rents were extraordinarily low. Nobody ever said, oh, my God, I'm being gouged on rent. Everybody, you could be a ditch digger, you could be anything. You could afford to buy a house. May not have been in Pacific Heights, may not have been in Seacliff or Knob Hill. You could afford to buy a house. You may be nervous by the mortgage payments, but if you had your job ongoing, which was jobs were pretty stable at that time, you could continue to make your mortgage payments. And so this is something that I think is very important, which I'll try to tie in together a little bit later on. 1945, in which World War II ended, the fears of another depression proved not to be true. And I always try to indicate to individuals when I'm talking or teaching or whatever that this was the golden age for this country. From 1945, which ended the war, and no longer did you have the crushing experience as you walked in the neighborhood of seeing a star suddenly go up on a window, which indicated somebody in that household had died. So this was gone, and the boys were coming home. And we began a period of about 25 years, which, as I said, certainly economic. It was the golden era of this country. We were purveyors to the world. All the developed countries, aside ourselves, had been devastated by the war. Germany and France and England and Japan and China. And so we sold them our goods. It was also a time for the United States in which people suddenly said, God, I've made all this money during the war. The Depression is, I couldn't spend anything during the Depression. I couldn't spend anything during the war because we were rationed. And now I've got all this money. I want a new ranch-style house in Orinda or whatever. I want this, I want that, a car, tires, etc. And suddenly there was this outburst of spending that absolutely fueled the economy in a way we will probably never, ever see again. In that sociological change that took place after World War II, we have some major developments, not just in San Francisco, but around the country. One was the flight to the suburbs. Among them, in the early 1950s, my parents. We want better weather, we want a nicer house, and that was multiplied. And so suddenly we begin an influx to Marin, influx to the East Bay, influx to the peninsula. And I must say, because my parents were big Sunday travelers, let's go see so-and-so in Los Gatos. Let's go see so-and-so in Oakland. And so, and I can still remember, these were wide open spaces. And suddenly there's one development after another which begin to fuel this whole operation. San Francisco up until probably 1955-60, was the magnet for the Bay Area. If you needed a specialist as a doctor, you came to San Francisco. If you needed to buy a particularly nice dress or suit, you came to San Francisco. If you wanted to eat at a particularly nice restaurant, you came to San Francisco. And this began to change in the 50s and 60s, in that the regional area, now with an increasingly dense population, began to provide their own, this brings us to the 1960s, which is, for me, the nexus of change, a change that is absolutely formidable. You had, and I'm not going to get on the details of this because I don't have the time for this, but you have a change in values. You have a change in customs. And I could give a litany that would never, you would have needed to bring your sleeping bags tonight to give you a litany of this. When I was working after coming downtown to work, I wore half the time a three-piece suit, the other half the time a regular suit, tie, even a hat, some of you may recall, and so forth. Online. Today I walk along Montgomery Street, where I don't see a tie for blocks. So this indicates a change in the mores, a change in the values, a change into the I'm okay, you're okay world we live in. There were extraordinary demographic changes, and this is one of the themes of my comments tonight. I grew up in largely a Caucasian world. They may have come from Germany or Italy or England or wherever, but it was a largely white world. There was the largest non-Caucasian minority were Chinese, who lived entirely in traditional old Chinatown. I had a classmate of mine at the University of San Francisco. His father was a very wealthy Chinese gentleman. And where do they live? They live in Chinatown. And right now, down the street lived poor people, wealthy people, people who had been well-educated, ill-educated, and so forth. They were virtually confined to China. Went up until World War II, there were very few African-Americans in San Francisco. Why? Because San Francisco has never been a major manufacturing center. And so when the migration from the South took place beginning the early part of the 20th century, particularly during World War I, then again during World War II, they went to the great manufacturing centers, Chicago, Boston, New York, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so here we see, for the first time really, a large number of African Americans coming to work in the various defense industries, if you will, in the Bay Area. So there's a sharp increase, not as much as in Oakland, not as much as in other places, but a sharp increase in the African-American population. That population rose to about 16% of the population of San Francisco in the aftermath of World War II, largely living in what we call the Western Addition, living in the southeastern part of the city, the Hunters Point Bayview area, and so forth. That population today, with a rapid depopulation of African-Americans in San Francisco, is now down to 4 to 6%. It's the lowest African American population in terms of percentages of any major U.S. city. The Asian population, I've never been able to find a real figure for this, but it was probably maybe 10%, confined largely to the old Chinatown area. And since the passage of the so-called Kennedy Immigration Acts in the 1960s, the population of the Asians in San Francisco, largely Chinese, is now 40%. The largest percentage of Asians, not numbers, but percentages, of any mainland U.S. city. The only city with a larger percent of Asians is Honolulu. What we've also seen, which is not generally discussed in consideration of demographics here, is the tremendous mobility which has come into this country, in which people from Oshkosh or from Mobile or whatever say, come here for vacation, say, oh, I love this city, I want to move here. And so we get, it's not possible to arrange by ethnic or racial considerations, but this has been a major factor in the changes of the city. One of the things that fascinates me, aside from how do people spend their time, is where do people live and how do they live? In 1948, the population of San Francisco rose to its highest point ever, 850,000 people. And there was no housing crisis. There was no question of affordable housing. Somehow 850,000 people were accommodated in reasonable houses, either that you bought or you rented. That population, both under the flight to the suburbs, or particularly under that aegis, began to decline in the late 1940s, 1950s. And so by the 1980s and 90s, the population of San Francisco got down to 600,000 people, and is now has recovered to about 800,000, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. So we have a big, big change in the population figures, a swing in the population. Now, this was never as bad as Detroit, which has always fascinated me. Detroit went from 2 million people in 1970 to 700,000 today. What we have here is a disappearance of the earlier configuration that I talked about earlier and a disappearance of the sense of communities that was true at that time. We saw beginning with what we call a liberal progressive agenda starting in the late 1960s. We see an incredible increase in government, in taxes, and in my own opinion, a wasteful governance. We see issues sharply divided. We see incivil discourse. We see the role of the politicians who today govern the city to be looking for ways of continuing that domination. It is that continuous because, for me, housing is a very important factor in any municipality. It is, I think, that sense that has made all the difficulties for people buying houses, whether it is rules against condominiumizing, flats, or whatever. I'm getting off my soapbox here, but in which literally there is an attempt to stop home ownership. And it is one of my contentions, as I'll talk about in a few minutes, as I end my comments, say, it is my sense that home ownership is one of the principal factors of a sense of owning, of belonging, of having a stake and root in the community. We have seen a collapse in education, and we have constant hand-wringing about this, and yet nobody over the years that I've noticed, 30 years, 40 years, has been able anything to do this. Well, as I take leave of the San Francisco of today, let me talk about something else which has been fascinating factor, and that is the tremendous change in what we do for a living. in this area. I grew up, again, in a world in which there was a huge diverse economy. Never, as I pointed out earlier, never a big manufacturing economy. You didn't have cars being made here. You didn't have coal being mined here. You didn't have the tremendous textile factories that you found in the Northeast. And so those great manufacturing centers of Boston, the Boston area, and New York, and Philadelphia, and Chicago, and Toledo, and Cleveland, and so on, did not exist here. What you had was an incredibly diverse multiplicity of small businesses, many of them connected with the sea. And so you had this enormous maritime world here that I can still remember with great, great passion as a boy, wandering around, visiting some friends of my parents on Telegraph Hill, looking down at night on the longshoremen or stevedores or whatever, emptying cargoes and filling cargoes, seeing those cargoes of coffee beans from Guatemala go up to MJB or Folgers or Hills Brothers, and if you were down in that area, smelling that wonderful aroma of roasting coffee. Gone. Gone. So the maritime world is gone. What manufacturing there was here is gone. And the world of small business, whether it's commercial printing or lithography or whatever, is gone. Well, I'm getting close to where Stephen's going to get a hook over here. So let's talk about the San Francisco 10 years from now. For a moment, close your eyes figuratively and think of the city that you've experienced in your own lives, however long or short you may have been here. Think of the city that you read about today in the Chronicle or the Examiner, or witness yourself walking the streets of San Francisco, driving the streets of San Francisco. And so one of the most difficult parts of this talk, as I've said already to Stephen, is the difficulty of saying, where will this be in 10 years? So for so many of us, what we hope will be is what we project will be, and that's, of course, unfair, because what we hope will be can sometimes be very different. Well, I think we're going to see tremendous changes. One is that this city, San Francisco, 46.7 square miles, is going to become, to the Bay Area, what Manhattan is to New York City. It will be where culture is concentrated. It will be where the wealthy live. It will be all those factors that those of you who travel to New York see in an ever-changing Manhattan. When I first started to go Manhattan to New York, by that I mean Manhattan, I loved it. And I love that tremendously diverse fabric. What are today's chic areas and Soho and whatever they're all called, where once these robust businesses functioning, brick buildings and so on, now totally, totally changing. And the same thing's happened in New York that has happened here. And those areas which we sort of spurned, or whether thought dangerous or difficult or whatever, those areas will provide homes and more sophisticated businesses in this Manhattanization of San Francisco. The suburban towns, I think, will fill the role very much of what the boroughs fill in New York City, Staten Island, Queens, and so forth on the line. Let's talk about business. This was never a major corporate center. If you were to go down for the last 50 years, 100 years, of the Fortune 500, you would see a small proportion in San Francisco. Nor will it ever be. The fact that a very successful company called Standard Oil California, now called Chevron, at one point said, we're getting out of here and moving to San Ramon. And this was, again, a sign and symbol of the fact that corporate life will never thrive in San Francisco. We will have no more traditional businesses. Food processing, which is a huge area in San Francisco, Del Monte and the three coffee companies I mentioned earlier, and so that has now essentially disappeared because of rising costs. Printing, merchandising support, warehousing for the goods that were sent out throughout the West, gone. We're seeing something now that I thought would never happen. the decline of San Francisco as a legal center. The other night I gave a talk, and a friend of mine who was there, we're talking about the demise of legal firms in San Francisco. There may be something even more, bigger factor there than just what's happened to Heller Ehrman or the other legal firms. But I think this, we're seeing a decline in this, and people used to say, San Francisco is the great legal center of the West. But I think what you are going to have in its place is the continued expansion of the financial world. And I know now, I mean, I know you all have great increases in your portfolios there, but this too will pass, and hedge funds and investment banking funds will come forth again, and this will be a big factor in San Francisco. And again, why? This is an expensive city to live in, and so you need businesses in which you have most of your employees bring in high figures. The second business I think will thrive in this area is the what I call the world of high-tech health, in which a friend of mine took me on a tour the other day of the Mission Bay complex of UCSF and so forth. This is going to be a big factor here in this city, a new business, a new format of that business. One of the fears I have is the ability of the current governance in the city to choke off small business. We see that small businesses, even those that are more advanced technologically, are under a tremendous problem. We see a huge increase in municipal taxes and some talk about increasing them again. We see the dealing with the bureaucracy, which I hear all the time, people are having a problem with this. And the various mandates. You've got to do this, you've got to do that, you've got to provide for this, that, and the other. And as I said, I'm giving my own fiscally conservative opinion here, that this will be a difficult situation. In the political world, which covers a multiplicity of issues, whether it's of governance, whether it's allocation of resources, housing, development, general and in the neighborhoods, law, crime, state of the infrastructure, these are all things we deal with every day. I've got a pothole in the street in front of my house. I've got somebody was mugged down the street. They want to put in a Walmart on Van Ness Avenue, whatever. And so these are the things that I am less sure about happening in the future, except to say, as I conclude, that I think that we are going to see a more conservative city. The city that we've seen beaten up by conservative pundits and so forth as a result of various aspects which they find funny, whether it's the legislation the supervisors passed some years ago forbidding discrimination against fat and short people, or forbidding discrimination between transsexuals, transgenders, and I don't know, transams for all I know, which admit is a bit of a laughingstock, that world I think is going to change. Why do I think it's going to change? Because I think the demographics of the city are changing once again. I talked about earlier that 40% of this city is Asian. Most of them immigrants from China or Thailand or whatever. And it is my sense, and this is not a caricature of Asians, that they are going to be very much desirous of owning property in the city, certainly owning a home. This is not something one can say just about the Chinese. It is a mark generally in this country's history of immigrants. And it is my very strong contention that if one is an immigrant or just a homeowner, again, you've got to, which is not to say the renters don't have a stake in the community, but it gives you a sense that economically, financially, you want a more conservative approach to government. We are seeing this Chinese influence, by the way, in this very year, in this past year. We now have three Chinese members of the Board of Supervisors, one who was just recently elected to the president of the board. We have a Chinese state senator, and the list goes on and on and on, and we're going to see more and more of that. In the past, the Asian community in this city is basically saying, oh, I don't care about politics. I just want to make my living and be happy. And now that's beginning to change, as we all know. And that, I think, will continue to change. Housing, I think, if that conservative trend does take place, as I'm particularly well, we'll see that the ability to buy housing will be increased, and that it will not be so difficult to fly in the face of buying a flat in a building or buying an apartment in a building and so forth on the line. I always love the conversation of the politicians about affordable housing. I would say, affordable to whom? And then we're going to see, I think, as part of the same climate, a more efficient and responsible government, unless I am totally mistaken in human nature, and friends of mine have told me that I frequently am, in which I think to myself, how can you go through this fiscal crisis this city is going through today and not come up with better solutions to handling revenues and expenditures? And so I think that some of that will actually come about in the next 10 years, in which government will become more efficient, become less expensive, and more responsible. I think when we go under the aegis of the whole area of allocation of resources, I think there my crystal ball is a little bit blank, because I frankly think we're going to see less and less resources, fewer and fewer resources, go into the whole cultural factor in the city. We're seeing this already. We've seen a few weeks ago one of the supervisors saying, let's slash the money given to the opera, the symphony, et cetera. And I think that's going to basically mean that these organizations, opera, symphony, ballet, museums, so forth on the line, are going to have to think more in the way of private partnerships between the private sector, the nonprofit sector, and the public sector, because we are not going to see, and we're not going to have the money to fund the largesse in the whole world of culture, theaters, and so forth online that we've seen in the future. When I walked here late this afternoon, I looked at this absolute luminescent sky, and I said, one of the things that always deflects any pessimism I have about the city is that this city is the Garden of Eden. The sheer beauty wants to make me cry, particularly on days like this, or on Monday when I drove down with my son-in-law along Highway 1 going down to the southern end of San Mateo County. And to see that absolute blue sky, the absolute opaque beauty of the air, the tremendous confluence of hills and sky and water. I thought, people want to be here. They'll make sacrifices to be here. They'll shove themselves into little apartments by the gross and want to live here because this is where they want to be. And that is one of the things, in the face of all these changes, all these challenges, all these difficulties, this is truly a city built upon hills. This is truly the land of Oz. Thank you very much for having me.
You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California featuring Charles Fracchia, founder of the San Francisco Museum and Historical Society. We're discussing the history of San Francisco now and then. I'm Stephen Seward, chair of the Now and Then Speaker Series and your moderator for tonight's program. I invite the audience to submit written questions for Charles. I think the way you wrapped your talk may have answered my first question. I was going to ask you, San Francisco in some ways is a provincial city, but we definitely command a presence on the world stage. And I was going to ask you why that is, but maybe the way you concluded your talk is the answer to that question.
Well, I think there's an extension of that as well. You mentioned earlier my forthcoming book, In the Gaulish in San Francisco. I have a theory, which I actually espoused in the introduction of that book, that the San Francisco from 1848 to 2009 is really the result of a unique set of circumstances setting up the city, circumstances of tolerance, circumstances of always something out there in the horizon that is going to better our lives. And that, I think, is what keeps people going here. And it is provincial in the sense of, people always compare this to New York. You can't probably get a pizza here at 4 o'clock in the morning, because who wants a pizza at 4 o'clock in the morning? You can't watch The Sorrow and the Pity at 6 o'clock in the morning, which is who wants to watch The Sorrow and the Pity? And so that's the contrast. So that, I think, you know, if you say, okay, I've got enough of what I want here, it's not so provincial.
Looking back, there's been... We've suffered as a city. There's been painful episodes. I'm thinking, of course, of the Moscone and Milk murders and the Jonestown massacre, the Port Chicago disaster. What was our city's darkest hour?
Whoa, that's a very good question. I actually think the darkest hour was probably the beginning of World War II, in which people actually feared an invasion coming up the Great Highway. And certainly in the San Francisco I grew up, I think that was probably the most fearful time. You know, the Depression went on for 10 years, and people either got used to it or didn't. But, I mean, it was not – you always felt you were going to somehow get through. But that was a real time of fear.
San Francisco has tackled major infrastructure projects in recent years. We've restored City Hall. We've completed the new DeYoung in the Academy of Sciences. We're building a new Bay Bridge and a central subway. And now the Doyle Drive project. How has San Francisco managed to tackle these major projects when other cities seem to struggle with infrastructure?
Well, I said in my talk tonight that of the cities of the United States, this city has actually fared very well comparatively. If you go to, I mentioned Detroit earlier tonight. If you go to Detroit, it looks like a war has been waged there. The population has gone down by two-thirds. I mean, it's astonishing. All the attempts to revive the city have gone by. Here, those attempts have succeeded. I think New York has had somewhat of a similar kind of situation. One of the factors about San Francisco, I think, that in which has been able to do this, is that it packs much more. I don't know, weight is the word I want, than its size. You know, we're talking about 800,000 people. We're talking about 47 square miles, give or take, and that's a very small area. And so we've been also very fortunate. Let's not forget that we've had politicians placed who've been able to get us a lot of money. I mean, City Hall, which I think is the handsomest municipal building in the country and maybe the world, was redone by a tremendous largesse from federal FEMA money. And you could go, you know, you could go down the line from many of these changes.
Is the dome at City Hall larger than the U.S. Capitol?
It is by 14 feet and 6 inches. It always amazes. I can't remember my name most of the time, but how do I remember that?
I'm going to get you into trouble now. Who was our least effective mayor during this period?
Whoa. Least effective mayor during this period, let's say, from... Well, let's say if you start in 43, Angelo Rossi was a very effective mayor, lost to Major Roger Lapham. And I'd like to put that. I'd like to put that that rather dubious distinction on Lapham's life. If for no other reason, he wanted to get rid of all the cable cars.
Well, so who was the best?
Well, I think probably. I hate to say this, but I will anyway. I think it was probably Dianne Feinstein. Dianne Feinstein. The reason I hate to say it is that I'm not totally in accord with the politics. But she was a very effective mayor. She was able to balance a number of different opposing viewpoints. And when she lost, for example, she was very much against the proposition that decreased the amount of office building it could be. And she was gracious about the defeat. Today, I mean, they come out with swords and, you know, battle to the death. So I think she was very, very effective at this. I would like to have said Joe Alioto, who was just a great presence. But as I said, he just came unglued for a variety of reasons.
And Diane, of course, saved the cable cars?
No, but Frieda Klusman saved the cable cars.
Okay. The Board of Supervisors in San Francisco is always a colorful bunch, but they seem to consistently be 10 to 15 years ahead of the nation. Why is San Francisco consistently on the leading edge of change?
Well, I think, as I mentioned earlier, the Gaulish, I think this city, as far as change, has been there for years and years and years, and I think that has been particularly true in the aftermath of World War II. in which social, social, political, economic, cultural aspects. You know, 1950s. Where was the cutting edge of literary and even to some extent artistic development? It was in San Francisco with the Beatniks, for example. In the 50s. In the 60s, say what you want about the Summer of Love and the hippies and whatever. I mean, this was a factor that swept the country and swept the world. Progressive ideas. San Francisco was the first city in the United States to decriminalize homosexuality. And then the state followed in 1966, passing legislation that began in 1967, saying that this should not be a felonious act. And it's gone on from there. I mentioned that, can't discriminate against fat people, short people, et cetera, and that has been now a tremendous drive in the city.
In 1986, the city joined a lawsuit against the International Olympic Organizing Committee over the use of the word Olympics, which had been used in San Francisco for what was called the Gay Games at the time, or what is now called the Gay Games. Do you think San Francisco is on a blacklist with the Olympics? Or is there another explanation as to why the city of San Francisco has not joined the elite list of Olympic host cities?
I must honestly say that I can't really answer that question because my interest in the Olympics is less than my interest in rocket science. And my idea of sports is having to get up off the couch from reading. So I can't really address that. I'm sorry.
Okay. I think this will interest you. After World War II, what was happening at the old Mint, and what's happening there now, and what's going to be there in the future?
Well, it does interest me, as a matter of fact. The old Mint served as a mint until 1937, and then after that was turned into offices for the Treasury Department. And then after that became a museum. So I'm sure many people here years ago went and toured the Mint when it was a museum. Then the federal government said, let's not pay any more money. It's a money loser. And so it was closed down for many, many years. Now, as of, 4 or 5 years ago, it was offered to the San Francisco Museum and Historic Society for $1 a year if we rehabbed it as the Museum of San Francisco History. And that's where we are today. It's a $100 million project. $35 million has been raised in public funds. We've got another $65 to go. And, of course, this is not a great era to be raising funds. But I think when it's done, it's going to be a showplace. I don't know. We're doing the Museum of Historic Society doing tours. If any of you want a tour of the old Mint, just call up the San Francisco Museum and Historic Society to give you a tour. It is absolutely, how many people have seen the museum here? It is absolutely fabulous. I mean, I recommend that everybody go down and take a look. It's really quite something.
There are a couple of questions here about the 49ers. Why are the 49ers seriously going to Santa Clara? What happened here? And when will the 49ers get their new stadium built in San Francisco, and will it ever be in Mission Bay or near AT&T Park?
Well, actually, that I can't answer because it has a...
We're back to sports.
We're back to sports, exactly. But for me, it's basically a matter of economics and does anybody here know that sports and money are really allied? And egos, huh? And so what you have in sports operations is wealthy people who own the sports team who want to suck as much money out of the community as they can. In most cases, interestingly enough, neither the players nor the coaches nor the owners live in the cities in which they are sponsoring their teams. So it becomes like I'll take Cincinnati, I'll take San Francisco, I'll take. And so what you have is, how am I going to maximize this? Now, the 49ers, as you know, had a bond issue which barely passed. To get $100 million out of the city, which is considered on the low side to do this. And those bonds have never been sold. They're just sitting there as part of this. And the owners of the 49ers want, obviously, luxury boxes, all the appurtenances to make a lot of money out of this team. And so that is at the root. They would prefer having it done in San Francisco. But since 60% of 49ers fans come from the peninsula, they're happy and willing to go down to Santa Clara. And so that's, and will it ever be built in Candlestick Park? I strongly doubt it. I think that eventually some move to the peninsula will take place.
You cross-referenced San Francisco and Manhattan several times, and a questioner is curious about the homeless issue, that there seems to be a big difference in Manhattan versus San Francisco, and what the future of that issue is in San Francisco.
Well, I'm now taking over as chairman of the Bring Rudy Giuliani to Become Mayor of San Francisco Committee. those of you who've been to San Francisco, and you know, people say, oh, yeah, he did. But those of you in New York, for example, I mean, I was there 2 years ago. I spent a month in the city. I saw two homeless people. I mean, two panhandlers, two homeless people. And, you know, I saw those in a third of a block in San Francisco when I got back. I don't know what the solution is. But you know what's interesting, I find? In 1906, at the earthquake and fire, the population of San Francisco was 400,000 people. 250,000 were rendered homeless by the earthquake and fire. They are all sheltered, fed, clothed, etc. And we have, what, 2,000, 3,000 homeless that for decades we have been unable to do anything about. So what is the reason for that? I have my own thoughts on it. I think that we have gotten such an elaborate, ineffective advocacy groups that the solution for the problem, which is for me, is shelter them, feed them, house them, shelter them, feed them, and clothe them, and give them some medical care. That may not be done in San Francisco, which is one of the two most expensive cities in the United States. So I find that I think it's absolutely inhuman and cruel to the homeless people to basically put them on the shelf as we have done.
I would like to put a finer point on some comments you made during your talk. Mm-hmm. Does the baby boom generation represent a golden era in America that will never be repeated?
Well, you know, I'm not of the baby boomer generation, as you may have discovered, but I feel that no generation says that this is the golden age of any generation. You know, we talk about the generation of World War II, which is a little bit older than I, and it was a heroic operation. They went through a depression. They went through a war. They built this, you know, this very affluent and vibrant society. And I don't see in the baby – you're really going to get me on my soapbox here. What I see in the baby boomers is something which I feel is very strong in our society today. And that is a very selfish, very narrowly focused generation. I don't think this is the golden age at all, which is not to say there are wonderful people. There are tremendous, wonderful people in that generation. But as a whole, I see it as narrow and selfish and not particularly giving.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we only have time for one more question, and it's about the Presidio. What are your thoughts about the Presidio Trust and the plan for development?
Well, keep in mind that the plan for development was mandated by the U.S. Congress. It has to be self-supporting in 2013. I have not been a particularly I'm a member of the Presidio Historical Society and so forth, but I've not really been on top of what's going on there. I think the development that's gone on thus far has been actually pretty decent, of trying to keep that balance between an operation that has to pay for itself and keep it somewhat pristine as a park. I've got some qualms architecturally about it, but I think the George Lucas operation there where the old Letterman Hospital was, I think is sensitive enough and lovely enough and so forth. I am very much, very much against the plans for the main post with the Fisher Museum and the Walt Disney Museum and the hotel and stuff on that line. That area, to me, is an extraordinarily sensitive architectural and natural environment that should be preserved. I mean, and I cannot believe that people who want their own museums or want this, want that, cannot build some other way in the Presidio, which would not be as intrusive on that particular fragile area.
Thanks to our speaker, Charles Fracchia, for his participation in the Now and Then series.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. I would also like to thank our listening audience, both here and on radio, for your attention here this evening. And we invite you to join the discussion by visiting the Now and Then blog at nowthenmlf.blogspot.com. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating 105 years of enlightened discussion is adjourned.